The harpsichord is so versatile that we might well wonder why anyone felt the need to invent the piano. Of course, it wasn't quite that simple. In the late 18th century, harpsichords and pianos, or pianofortes, coexisted. But what did the makers and players of harpsichords do to compete with the new keyboard instruments? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
When and why was the harpsichord invented? How versatile did it become? Which is to say, how many bells and whistles did it have eventually? What kind of music does it play best? And why did it give way to the forte piano? To find out, we're at the First Unitarian Society Meeting House in Madison, and at the harpsichord is Trevor Stevenson, the founder of Madison Bach Musicians and a player of harpsichords, forte pianos, and Victorian pianos.
And welcome to University of the Air.
Good afternoon. It's my pleasure.
We're here in this beautiful Frank Lloyd Wright building,
yes.
And you're sitting at a harpsichord. Can you describe it? Because this is, after all, radio. But tell us about the instrument that you're sitting at.
This is a two-manual harpsichord. It's a French in design. Two manuals means there are two keyboards here, so I have a lot of choices even within those two keyboards. So it's kind of the Cadillac of the 18th century instrument. It's not only, you know, as large a harpsichord as they ever made and as heavy a one, but it has as many, you know, features as they could possibly get on it. If you can imagine, it's about 7.5 feet long and probably, 200-some pounds. So it's barely portable. It absolutely fills the back of a van, which we found out, and moving it to the shop to repair it. This instrument is painted in a beautiful kind of a red paint with gold trim and some dark, dark blue to black paint as well, and a very decorated soundboard, decorated in the fashion of the period, the mid-18th century in France, with beautiful flowers and birds and things like that. I guess this may be just flowers, right? Right. You can tell how often the keyboard player really looks inside. We spend most of our life at the keyboard. But this one is done with just flowers. This was made in the late 1970s by Mark Rosé, who lives here in Shorewood, just a few blocks from here. Mark assembled this from a kit made by the Hubbard Company. So Mark bought the parts for it and then spent several years, hard years, putting this all together. We always say, don't start on Christmas Eve with a project like this. It's a huge undertaking. And he completed this in 1979. I'm trying to think of other things that would make it
what sort live. Of wood? What sort of wood is it made out of?
Harpsichords, if you start with the sounding board, which is the thing that really gets the energy from the wires and gets it into the air so that we can hear it, the sounding board is made of spruce, usually what they call a Sitka spruce. It's a very tight-grained wood that gives the best kind of overtones and ring to the sound. And so most instruments use this kind of a spruce. Some instruments use cedar and other woods, but this one has Sitka spruce in it, I believe. And the case is made of all sorts of different kinds of woods, depending on, what part of it, the bottom is sometimes, made of a pine or something like that. And since Mark built it and I didn't, I don't know what type of boards they selected for that. Some laminates were also used, perhaps in the bend of the instrument. They sometimes use a laminate, which is in the plywood family. Other times not. It all depends on who put it together. This is the optimal range keyboard from the 18th century, which is a 5 octaves plus an extra note on the top. So everything that Mozart wrote, and certainly everything that Bach wrote, and even that Scarlatti wrote, who used a very expanded range, all fits on here. 5 octaves going from the low F and then middle C, sitting pretty much right in the middle of the range, and then ending with a high G, some 2.5 octaves above that. Listen, here's the highest part. And what the wonderful thing about this is that you can hear it changing. Every 3 or 4 notes, there's a change of color. Now we're dropping into the alto. And here's another change right at middle C. And you can hear the male voice kicks in, right? And it starts to get this, we always call it the chesty sound of the male. And it just gets dumber as it goes, Listen. like that. So that, and that the beauty of harpsichords is that the top and the bottom and everything in between suggest probably, oh, 8 or 10 different vocal tessituras. There's a greater sense of spaciousness on the harpsichord than on the piano. That is of distance between the parts. And when played well, I think that's its a real strong point. You could hear it even in the Bach invention that... There's a sense that those are almost 2 or 3 octaves apart if you played it on the piano in color. Another, you know, great change in color is from the upper keyboard to the lower. The upper keyboard plucks the string much closer to the end, the termination, and so you get a more nasal oboe-like sound. We were talking about oboes earlier. You listen to that same riff on the lower keyboard. It's much sweeter and more flute-like, like that. So that these are two very strong tools that the player has to use.
How about sustaining notes, though? How good is it at that?
Right, sustaining is done. An individual note sustains as you hold it, but its envelope, we call it, is so different than the piano. Harpsichord has a huge amount of energy at the beginning, and then it has a little bit of a bloom, and then you hear it drop off rather quickly. At the point where this harpsichord and any harpsichord is dropping off, the piano is still waking up. It's only on its second cup of coffee, you know, and it's just, you know, it's just beginning to open its sound like that. So the piano has a great delay built right into it. And the good thing is, you know, in Debussy and all of that, that delay allows you to get these beautiful clouds and everything like that. Conversely, the delay makes the counterpoint a little bit muddy, right? And so the harpsichord really specializes in clarifying those kind of textures because the sounds are dropping away and getting out of each other's way as they go. The way that we sustain on the harpsichord is through ornamentation. So you
just
know,
keep playing it.
Why don't you? All those doodads and ornaments that Bach added to that, right, keep this floating. Otherwise, you got... Which is very nice, but listen. There's some, and it makes it spin on up into the vault of the room like that. So it keeps keeps the plates in the air.
Keep those plates spinning.
The carnival guys would say, right? It really does, and it's an amazing thing. And I'm certainly not making that up. Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach said that on the keyboard you are to add ornaments and to sustain as much as possible and sound like a good singer. But that's a great point about how we sustain, and we'll see how the French keyboard music and their elaborate ornamentation, how they keep it going. There are, of course, exceptions, but this piece by Couperin, it would be a good example, I think, of how it's layered. And you can hear that Couperin really, he understood the way sound moves inside this echo chamber of the harpsichord, as well as Chopin understood the way sound moved inside the piano, and all the way that the notes really bounce off each other in a beautiful way.
I see that Couperin writes in his preface, and you hear that sort of expression there. He writes, "The harpsichord is perfect as to its compass and is brilliant in itself, but as it is impossible to swell or diminish its tones, I shall always be thankful to those who, by means of infinite artistry, borne up by good taste, shall succeed in making the instrument capable of expression."
Right, right, exactly, right. And that... no one knows how it's done, but somehow it is possible, right? I would think the harpsichord is like a black and white photograph. You know, we don't see in black and white, we see in color, but a black and white photograph can tell us something about the world that you can't get from a color photograph in the hands of an artist. It's something to do with the discipline of its limitations. And so anyway, it's very mysterious how it works. I mean, I know I can explain some of the tricks that go on, you know, with timing and feathering things and all of that. One thing we try not to do is to play notes at exactly the same time, even though they're written so that they look like they're at the same time. We break them in dozens of different ways, consciously or unconsciously, that keeps the thing floating. If you play a bunch of notes on the harpsichord at the same moment, you get a breaking dishes kind of sound, you know. I mean, you do that, right? And two or three of those and you start to lose your listener, you know. I mean, you know, that is, it's just, it's a, you know, once in a while it's great, but it really is kind of a shattering sound. But when we, you do that, that's the same chord. And now suddenly the whole instrument is lighting up and there's this spinning and rotation that's going on in there. Well, you know, if you add that up over, you know, over time, start to do that, it's a beautiful thing. And of course, the trick in this music is to play sort of in time, but not too much in time. Right? If you play it really metronomically, it will also is off-putting for the listener as well.
Could you give us a sample of a Rameau piece?
Sure, yes. He's very different from Couperin. In Rameau, the structure is much more powerful. I think Mozart probably learned a lot from Rameau and much less from Couperin, in that you have a clear theme that's delineated. And you notice that in the Couperin, I mean, you're kind of awash the whole time. You're not quite sure where you are in the form, which is really his genius. But Rameau is completely on top of everything. This is a piece called The Tambourine, and what been done probably is an approximation of something Rameau heard either in a cafe or on a street. And I'm going to add another set of strings in here so that the sound is... And now it sounds much more like a public kind of presentation. And we'll mix it up a little bit.
Is a distinctively French rhythm, isn't it? That
yeah.
Uneven accentuation.
Yes. Yeah, right. Yes.
And but, playful, too.
And playful, right. I mean, I think there must have been like a exotic element here with maybe a Turkish band or something. And the harpsichord, when you add the extra set of strings, it makes the tambourine sound come in like that. I mean, it's got a kind of a fizz built right into it, like the tambourine. So it's a portrait of a street scene.
Well, we'll take the harpsichord to Italy if we haven't left France. We might even get back to France again. You never know.
Right.
But we'll certainly go to Germany, too, before the hour is done. And you're listening to University of the Air on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We invite you to browse our website, wpr.org, You're likely to find much that interests you about Wisconsin Public Radio and the people and programs you hear every day. WPR.org.
Brave young man dressed in black and in a black wig who had stood in one corner of the room very quiet and attentive while Rosengrave played, being asked to sit down to the harpsichord, when he began to play, Rosie said, he thought 1,000 devils had been at the instrument. He never had heard such passages of execution and effect before. The performance so far surpassed his own, and every degree of perfection to which he thought it possible he should ever arrive, that, if he had been in sight of any instrument with which to have done the deed, he should have cut off his own fingers. That's the impression that Domenico Scarlatti's keyboard playing had on one of his contemporaries, Thomas Rosengrave.
Wow.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Trevor Stevenson. We're here at the first Unitarian Society meeting house, and Trevor is at the harpsichord demonstrating its stuff.
Its stuff, right. And some of Scarlatti's riffs, right.
And that was such a different sound than the French playing that you did. Can you give us some sense of the Italian style and Scarlatti in particular?
It's hard to believe it's the same instrument, really. Well, the first thing you notice is that he writes high. I mean, not all the time, but the Italians put such a premium on brilliance, right? So there's brilliance everywhere in Scarlatti's. And also concision, too. Everything is probably as tight as it could be.
Well, in a 3-minute sonata, I guess it has to be.
Right.
All of the Scarlatti sonatas, you said there were about 500
around
of them,
500.
And they're all about 3 minutes long.
And as far as we know, he wrote in many genres up until his 40s or so. And it, somewhere in his 40s, he decided to quit writing other things and to focus on these 3- and 4-page keyboard sonatas and really was, as brilliant as he was something of a late bloomer and was churning these out at a great rate in the last 20 years or so of his life. It's almost as if he discovered a novelist discovering late in their career that they're really a short story writer, you know. And we often compare Scarlatti to Hemingway and that how Hemingway is so brilliant. You just can't believe that anyone could get to make it that vivid on the page, you know, and that's what Scarlatti does too. And it's interesting that they both end up in Spain too, because Scarlatti's an Italian who goes to Spain, and Hemingway, of course, ends up going into the Spanish Civil War and is obsessed with Spain. And I think what they both found in Spain that was very attractive was this incredible passion and directness. It is as direct as possible. So I'm sure, among other things, the wine was probably very good too.
And if you're going to play, as you are in a minute, a sonata by Scarlatti, what are some of the demands on you as a performer?
Well, you know, I mean, it's in many ways it's quite liberating. I mean, it's written. Scarlatti's music, like Chopin's music, is written at the keyboard. You can tell there, so he never asks you to do something that isn't natural. It may be difficult, but it's always natural. And the many, many great composers didn't work like that. They wrote the music kind of as they heard it in their head, and then God help you at the keyboard, you know, whatever gymnastics you have to do to make it happen. So Scarlatti is very friendly that way. I think also that in Scarlatti, he's so idiomatic for the harpsichord that he's plugged into its sense of rhythm. I mean, if we just look at this opening of the one I'm going to play first. He's so attuned to how the attack of that note is going to, in a way, really give birth to the following note. And I think you can tell that these pieces were worked out over hundreds of repetitions and sessions at the keyboard. Scarlatti, sometimes we characterize him as a bit of a diarist, really. I mean, he's in his room looking out the window and then writing down kind of what he sees of the world. And there's an odd sort of detachment in it, I think. It's just something that I feel in his music, and it's very compelling because he's in the crowd but not of it. And I think we'll hear that especially in the bullfight. This one really will end up in a bullfight with the bull getting the worst of it. Yeah. It's a bullfight transposed onto a keyboard.
It sounds, you know? That sounds very Spanish.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's got this very spinning quality to it. Almost, you can almost see the cape.
Oh, yeah. Turning. Oh, right. And at the climax, he shows the sword comes out a few measures later. That's the crowd. And there, that must be the crowd going, oh, because the bull is done for, you know. Right, and he even uses the note of death on the old tunings, which is the A flat. I mean, it's the note that symbolized mortality.
And does he add notes that say this is a bullfight?
No.
This is the
sword.
Then how do you know?
Right? Oh no, you know, you never know. I'm just, right. This is just my impressions of it. Right.
But that's convincing.
But I think it's
works for me.
What's that?
It works for me. I just didn't know if he added.
Oh no,
marginal notes.
I don't want to give the wrong impression. The page is just notes on there, just black dots. Right. But this piece is particularly a scene, I think, this bullfight piece. Maybe we should do it first and then talk about the imagery. Right. So the first, these are two sonatas in F minor, which is a highly polarized kind of key on the harpsichord. The key of F minor has this chord in it, which has an A flat sitting right in the middle of it. And because of the well temperament that they used in the 18th century, every key was a little bit different. And F minor has this very pungent sound built right into it. When you put it into a chord, it's quite opaque, really. It almost hits you like a wall. And then the dominant in F minor is C major, which is the clearest of all the tuned keys in this temperament. So the polarization comes in that the tonic is so distraught, you know, almost like a breast-beating kind of sorrow. And the dominant is the ocean, is completely without waves at all. And you can hear Scarlatti working that right from the beginning.
Well, if it doesn't kill the bullet, it might kill the harpsichord.
You're right, Mike. You're right. It's like the Earl King, right? Like Schubert's the Earl King, right, yeah. Right. The pianist is dead at the end. The horse is fine, you know, but the pianist is dead. Yeah, and it's just an amazing piece of music. It's really a thrill. I like out in the second half, he really brings the crowd into the... this. And that's an A-flat major, which, again, is the honkiest of all the keys. And he's using it to make it sound like a lot of people yelling.
Almost sounds like trumpet fanfares right. In there, too. Bum, bum, bum.
Right. And then he goes to the dirtiest of the keys, which is E-flat minor. It's very... I mean, Scarlatti's an incredible genius is that instead of writing what anybody else would have written, which is this, he goes, right, there's always a worm in the rose, right? There's always, there's some bug in there. And it's from the very beginning, he's always got something that sets the measure off balance and pulls you into the next measure. And then I think the first movement is such a beautiful poem, too, you know. That one. And again, I'm using the two manuals of the keyboard to get kind of the loneliness of the bull ring. Must be at night before the fight or something like that. Right?
And can you make any volume change on the harpsichord? It seems
only by playing more notes.
You can't, no matter how hard you hit it, it's always going to be the same
Actually,
volume.
I found out that the harder you hit it, probably the less sound you get. If you think of it, you've got a string there in space and a quill that's going to come up past it. If the quill goes by the string very quickly, it doesn't really have time to grab it. It just kind of flits by. But if you press the key, you know, you grab the string and then press the key, you can kind of lift it and you get more bloom to the sound. So one of the tricks of playing the harpsichord is that even when you're playing very fast, you try to kind of push the keys down a little bit slowly. You try to get the key moving beforehand like that. And you don't play very, you know, hard to the bottom of the key. I wish I could show you that. If I press really hard, you get a lot of wood,
yeah,
right?
I hear that.
But if I just grab them, I get that, which is a sweeter kind of a sound.
To Handel and Bach right after this. You're listening to University of the Air on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
At portalwisconsin.org, visitors can navigate content through a variety of means, including searches by keyword, subject area, and date. Content is updated almost daily. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to invite you to visit portalwisconsin.org.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Trevor Stevenson, and we're talking about the harpsichord on location here at the First Unitarian Society Meeting House. Trevor, you've been talking about first the French style and then the Italian style.
Right.
As we turn to Germany with composers like Handel and Bach, what sort of different sound do we get on the harpsichord?
Yeah, and Handel, of course, is a strange case because he grows up in Germany, and then at the age of 19 or so, moves to Italy to absorb everything he can about Italian singing and virtuosity. And then he marries that really to his German harmonic and contrapuntal training and goes to England and starts writing these operas and oratorios in a fused style between the two, and we get Messiah and all those. So I think what we're going to hear in Handel is a little more harmonic grounding, which is that I know this is probably a hard thing to do over the air, but it's a more well planned out harmonic structure than maybe in Scarlatti or some of the Italian pieces like that. And Handel starts with a fantasy in this prelude. It's really kind of a free form. He even has places where he doesn't write the music out at all. He just gives you the chord and says, riff away. You know, I mean, you just do whatever comes to you like that. And then in the dances that follow, we'll hear him shift to almost a French style and integrate that into his thing. And this tendency to integrate everything is what Bach does better than anyone. He never travels, but he uses Italian and French music all the time and puts them into his German style and puts it through what we call the Bach sausage grinder, you know, and it all comes out Bach. You can hardly separate the influences. It's so cleverly done. But it couldn't have been done without all those European styles working together. And this is a very self-conscious part of the 18th century, was to build a trans-European style. They wrote about it all the time, and Bach and Handel are living examples of what could be done with it. I think in the opening of this Handel suite, we're going to hear Handel, the great organist. You know, so a lot of this music was played not only on the harpsichord, but on the organ as well. And you can hear, this. I mean, it's only a nod away from, from what we were talking about before, and in the same key. So the organ makes much more of an appearance, even in the harpsichord writing of these German masters. Handel, Bach, and Scarlatti, of course, are all born, spookily enough, in the same year. And it's spooky because they are head and shoulders, really, above the other composers of the era. And it is an odd thing that 1685 is the year that brought these three great composers, and three composers whose lives go very divergent directions. I mean, Scarlatti into this highly personalized, idiosyncratic, secular style, and Bach, who wrote everything he wrote, is religious, and then Handel, who's more of a theater guy. He's almost always got one eye on the audience, saying, are you having a good time, and where should we go from here? So very different.
Well, let's hear the suite in D minor by Handel, and can you tell us the names of the five movements you'll be playing?
Yeah, it starts with this prelude in a fantasy or improvised style, and then it goes into the really standard format, what they always use for dance suites, which was an allemande, which is a rather moderate 4-4 kind of dance, from which we get the allemande left, allemande right. And then there's a courante, which is a rather quick dance in triple time, and then there's the very famous sarabande that people have heard and played since they were kids on the piano. Like that. And I'll maybe get out one of the special stops on here and see if that's going to fly for the sarabande. And then the usual order was to end with some kind of a gigue or a jig, what we would call a jig, which is a fast dance and usually some kind of compound triple. Like that. So we'll start with the prelude here. Thank you.
Suite in D minor by Handel with all those Baroque dance movements.
Yeah,
quite a variety you get there of styles.
Right. Yeah, it's wonderful. It's a very short piece, really, but it's amazing how far he really goes.
A technical question here. What about this well-tempered
business? Is this well-tempered stuff? Right. In the 18th century, they came up with a new tuning system, really. One that had not been known before and in many ways was not used much after World War I. It rules the 18th century and a good part of the 19th century, and it was called well temperament. It was a tuning in which you could play in every key for the first time. Before the 18th century, they tuned in a fashion called mean tone, in which half of the keys were gorgeous, much more beautiful than anything that we know on keyboards today. And the other half of the keys were trashed, right? And it was a heaven and hell model, which was suited the old Italian temperament very well. And in the 18th century, they decided that they would compromise the incredible beauty of those keys in the what we call the upper half of the circle of fifths, keys like C, F, and G, which had been so radiantly beautiful in the old tuning. They would compromise those if they could bring into play the keys at the bottom of the circle so that they could have 12 different flavors, right, 12 majors and 12 minors. And this was an amazing compromise, and it comes from the age of checks and balances from the 18th century. It's a kind of an experiment in democracy.
Yeah, it has a democratic sound.
Yeah, it does.
Bring
right.
the load up.
Right, and
the
high down.
High a little
exactly.
bit down, and everybody can play.
And everything was tuned in the 18th century. Many forms of well temperament were tuned, including a form of it called equal temperament, in which everything was tuned exactly the same. Everything was compromised exactly the same way. And these two tunings competed with each other and were all very viable throughout the 18th and the early 19th century, really even with a lot of documentation into the late 19th century, so that every key had its own flavor. And what the well temperament did was that it was based around C major, so that C major still represented the kind of purity of beginnings and origins. And if you listen to C major, and that's the quality of the third. It's always the quality of the third in any key that dictates its basic flavor. You can hear the C and the E are very calm. So keys like C had this great inner stillness. And the more accidentals any key had, the more bubbly it got. So there's G. It's going wah, 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 wah. And here's C. Wah, 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 wah. Now, if this were equal temperament, the way the pianos were tuned through the 20th century and are still tuned for the most part now, everything would be beating wah, 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 in every key. But here, we tuned it this way. They all are different. So in the well-tempered clavier, when Bach starts off, he starts in C major because it was about origins and beginnings, and he's getting a genesis effect, you know. And it's about harmony, you know. And all about this glow, you know. If he had put that in a key like C sharp, which has, you know, these incredible fangs, you know, but it's still usable. There's C sharp. Like that. Or F sharp, which is even thornier. Like that. If you put that in C sharp, you get this. I mean, it's still beautiful music. You can't kill it with a stick.
But it's different.
But it's different, and it loses that sense of, in the beginning, you know, God created the heavens. And you see that?
Yes.
And see. And so they really worked a lot with this, and the well-tempered clavier was a study in 24 key colors, you know, 12 majors, 12 minors. And, you know, Bach, the great, like a German biologist or something, he's going to show you the possibilities in everything. So that's 600 words or less on well temperament. But it was a very, very important thing. And huge treatises were written about it in the 18th and 19th century. And people almost came to daggers about the differences, of course, with their beliefs. It got kind of nasty sometimes. But I think you can see why they wrote in the keys that they did. D minor has this very primordial. We heard it in the Handel, right? Like that. And or it's the inner fire of the soul. It's probably no coincidence that Don Giovanni is in D minor. You know, it is the key of fire.
Brief comment on why the harpsichord got replaced by the piano.
In the early 18th century, there was an Italian harpsichord builder named Cristofori who took one of his harpsichords and pulled the action out of it, the plucking action, and put a hammered action into it. And if I'd had enough foresight, I would have brought my forte piano today. You could have heard that in comparison with the harpsichord. What the hammered action gave him the ability to do was to create dynamics. You can shade things. You can make things louder and softer, and you can shape them the way a human voice or a violin would do, you know, so that the line kind of pushes and pulls. What it also did by using a hammer on a string is created this rather overtone, depleted kind of sound. And the piano is much duller in its tone than the harpsichord. And so they gained dynamics, and they lost this kind of spiritual presence that the harpsichord, a good one, has. That if I played that same riff on the piano, I mean, you'd be asleep, you know, in a few seconds. But on the harpsichord, a melody like that is an event because of the spiritual quality of the pluck of the string. Like that, the piano, to get spiritual qualities, has to go to a completely new kind of writing, right? And so it changes. Music changes dramatically. Maybe not because of the piano, but because taste was changing in the piano, I think, accompanied this taste. When Thomas Jefferson went to Paris in the 1780s, he came back not with harpsichords, but with, I believe, a couple of forte pianos. It was certainly the rage, and it was the new taste. And the harpsichord represented really I think the harpsichord is one of the last ties to the Renaissance, and the piano becomes really what Romanticism is going to become. And Mozart is the first great forte pianist. He does not write for the harpsichord. Just for a laugh, you have to hear Mozart on this is two measures of Mozart on the harpsichord.
It's back like, to that right.
Shattering dishes thing.
Because you can't shade the left hand. You can't pull it back or do anything, you know, romantic
you
with it.
You have to embellish everything to tie that together.
Right. Yeah. So it, you know, on the piano, you can push the left hand back and then bring the right hand out and put a little spin on everything. Here, you know, it just sounds like a carnival, right? Or we always say those old murder mysteries, you know, with the people sneaking around the house, you know. I mean, it's ludicrous. So music changed, and I think it was an amazing revolution, and probably as big a revolution in sound as we've ever heard in any given 100 years. I think this is the great watershed for the West. And all instruments in the 18th century changed the same way. They all got rid of their overtones, you know, pushed the overtones out and articulation out in favor of a smoother, kind of a more fundamental type sound.
Some Bach to take us out?
Yeah. Goldberg Variations, right.
Thank you.
a small sample of the massive Goldberg variations of Bach and a small sample of what the harpsichord can do with all of its versatility. Thank you,
Trevor
Stevenson, for joining us here at the First Unitarian Society Meeting House. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. Our engineer has been Brad Kohlberg for this hour, with some assistance from Rich Grody. Thanks for joining us. Hope you can be with us for the next hour of University of the Air. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 as we prepare an early celebration of the life of Robert Burns in time for his birthday, with a look at his poetry, which ranges quite a bit through those Scottish countrysides. It's next Sunday afternoon at 4, Robert Burns here on Wisconsin Public Radio.